This is the fifth day of this June 2018 seven-day session. And we'll go back to this anthology of various Chinese Zen masters. We left off with the great Da Wei, 12th century Chinese master. He starts by quoting someone, he doesn't attribute it. When you have no mind, Zen is easy to find. And then he explains, in Zen terminology, no-mindedness does not mean insensitivity or ignorance. It means that the mind is stable and does not get stirred up by the situations and circumstances one encounters. It means the mind does not grasp anything. It is clear in all situations, unimpeded and undefiled, not dwelling on anything, even non-defilement. Sometimes this term no-mindedness is translated as mindlessness, but that's not the best English connotation. He continues, good and bad come from your own mind. But what do you call your own mind, apart from your actions and thoughts? Where does your own mind come from? If you really know where your own mind comes from, boundless obstacles caused by your own actions will be cleared all at once. After that, all sorts of extraordinary possibilities will come to you without your seeking them. It's sort of the question in the Zen tradition. Mind. What is this mind? In Zen, we often distinguish between mind with a small m and mind with a capital M. This is the former, small m being just ordinary so-called higher mind of brain functions, basically. And mind with a capital M is far, far beyond that. Zen Master Dogen said, you think that your mind is thoughts and concepts. That's mind with a small m, but it is mountains and rivers and grasses and stones. This mind with a capital M is not apart from objects. It embraces and encompasses subject and object, transcends both. Here's another one. Many people who practice Zen are in a burning rush to learn Zen when their worldly affairs are not to their satisfaction, but then give up Zen when they become successful in the world. Well, this is an old story. Successful in the world, I think I see this more often with people whose love life is going well. They aren't as often not as interested in Zen practices when it's not. Or people who get involved with someone, start up a relationship, almost inevitably that's going to become their preoccupation. It's going to push their practice out of their mind, or push the deeper questions about coming and going out of the mind. Such a poignant thing, really, to see someone who is really, really engaged with the Dharma, practicing hard, going to Sesshin, and then starting up a relationship and seeing them veer off into that world, which is normal human world. And I always console myself that it's just a temporary thing, that it's only a matter of time before that relationship starts to bite into one and engender plenty of questions or reasons to practice. It's nothing to really to lament about it. It's just that's just the way we're wired. I've come to see. Zen addresses some of the more fundamental issues of birth and death, suffering. He says, when you have attained mental and physical peace and quiet, don't get stuck in peace and quiet. Be independent and free like a gourd rolling and bobbing on a river. That is, not to be attached to peace and quiet, not to fall under the spell of stillness. Very strong mandate in Zen practice. People sometimes ask why we have kinin, why we are required when there's kinin to get up and join the kinin. Well, it is. There's various things you could say about it, but one is that you run the risk of getting attached to sitting meditation. And kinin is an opportunity to practice moving meditation. Very important. Outside of Sesshin, we have a lot more, many more hours in the day when we're really moving meditation is we have to settle for, we have to do. So we have to learn to apply the stability and quiet that comes from sitting. We need to apply it to our everyday life, and kinin is a way to do that. It's a bridge because we're walking in a formal, structured way with the hands on the chest, and it's sort of halfway between sitting and moving, ordinary kind of moving about in the world. This image of a gourd rolling and bobbing on a river is one of the favorite ones in Zen tradition. The freedom of that it conveys. It's very much like clouds and water. In Japanese, a Zen monk is referred to as unsui, clouds and water. Because it points to the kind of adaptability and non-attachment that we cultivate through Zen practice. Same as a gourd rolling and bobbing on a river. Moving along with things rather than standing apart, standing against, opposing, obstinately, separating oneself. There's a lot of Taoism in Zen. We see that in these same images. Here's a longer one. People are backwards. Ignorant of the true self, they pursue things, willingly suffering immeasurable pains in their greed for a little bit of pleasure. In the mornings, before they've opened their eyes and gotten out of bed, when they're still only half awake, their minds are already flying about in confusion, flowing along with random thoughts. Although good and bad deeds have not yet appeared, heaven and hell are already formed in their hearts before they even get out of bed. By the time they go into action, the seeds of heaven and hell are already implanted in their minds. Who can't relate to this, about getting out of bed and having the mind in a royal thoughts? He quotes the Buddha, all faculties of sense, all faculties of sense are receptacles manifested by your own mind. Physical bodies are manifestations of your own mind's representations of forms subjectively imagined. These manifestations are like the flow of a river, like seeds, like a lamp, like wind, passing away from instant to instant. Frenetic activity, attraction to impure things, and voracity, greed, are the causes of the useless, deceptive habits that seem to have always existed like a water wheel always turning. So this is quite a handful here to break down. He refers to physical bodies. We all can think of the mind. The body is kind of a condensation of energy. It's a concrete aspect of the mind. And our bodies, he says, are manifestations that have no enduring substance to them, like the flow of a river, like seeds, that is, seeds that blow in through the air on a June day in the country, like a lamp, like wind, passing away from instant to instant. Our senses are not acute enough to really see our bodies in this flux. But they are, of course. Science confirms that. Molecules and subatomic particles are all in flux constantly. Cells dying and being reborn moment by moment, nanosecond by nanosecond. But we can't see this with our own senses, so it's sort of an intellectual thing, conceptual thing, when we hear these kinds of confirmations from physics. But this sentence deserves a reread. Frenetic activity, attraction to impure things, and voracity are the causes of the useless, deceptive habits that seem to have always existed like a water wheel always turning. This is the life of most people, the daily lives and the life as a whole of most people. And it's what brings us to practice. When we catch on about how we're misusing our time on this earth, in this body, this human body, He continues, if you really see through this, you know that heaven and hell are nowhere else but in the heart of the half-awake individual about to get out of bed. They do not come from outside. This is the premise of meditation, is the way we use or misuse the mind that by which we create our heavens and hells, our miseries and joys. The work has to start with the mind. From the mind comes actions, words and actions. To change, we have to change the mind. He continues with this. While in the process of waking up, you should really pay attention. While you are paying attention, you should not make any effort to struggle with whatever is going on in your mind. While struggling, you waste energy. As the third ancestor of Zen said, here he's quoting Affirming Faith in Mind, Sun Tzu, attempts to stop activity will fill you with activity. So just as a basic principle, not to oppose what's going on in the mind. If that would help, then why not? Zen is very practical, but fighting the mind in any way is not going to work. But to bring awareness to it, to see what's going on, this is where we can avoid being caught by it. When you notice that you are saving energy in the midst of the mundane stress of daily affairs, this is where you gain energy. This is where you attain Buddhahood. This is where you turn hell into heaven. Here's a very short one. When you have even a single thought of looking for a shortcut in Zen, you have already stuck your head in a bowl of glue. Looking for a shortcut means that one is caught in ideas of time, of now and then, past, present, and future. Expectations, impatience. These are all impediments to practice. The best thing we could do in Zen practice is forget about time. People have been used by the mind's conceptual consciousness since before they can remember, flowing in the waves of birth and death, unable to be independent. If you want to leave birth and death to be joyfully alive, if they want to, they must cut through decisively, stopping the course of mind's conceptual consciousness. And we have the tool to do that. It's called the breath. It's called the koan. Shikantaza. It's by holding fast to these practices that we can stop the course of mind's conceptual consciousness. And then one final one from Da Wei. The Buddha said that when the mind does not grasp things of the past, does not long for things of the future, and does not dwell on things of the present, then one realizes that past, present, and future are empty. Don't think about past events, whether good or bad, for if you think about them, this impedes the way. Don't calculate future matters, for if you calculate, you go mad. Don't fix your attention on present affairs, whether unpleasant or pleasant, for if you fix your attention on them, they will disturb your mind. Just deal with situations as they happen, and you will spontaneously accord with these principles. It takes a certain amount of faith to move through life without an agenda or without unnecessary plans. Of course, we need to plan at times, but some people just live so much of their life in the future, worrying, rehearsing, planning, calculating. Such a diminished way to live one's life. The present is just passing us by when we're lost in thoughts of the future, and of course, same with the past. The next master in this collection of Chinese masters is Hongzhi. The book seems to be organized chronologically, so it's, you know, roughly 12th century, maybe 13th century, I suppose. No dates given. He says, the mind originally is detached from objects. Reality basically has no explanation. This is why a classical Zen master said, our school has no slogans and no doctrine to give people. Fundamentally, it is a matter of people arriving on their own and finding out for themselves. Only then can they talk about it. Finding out for themselves, the school of direct experience. This phrase, no explanation, reality basically has no explanation. Well, of course, it is what it is, what we call reality. This is what it is. Explanations are just an overlay. There's a line from a verse in the Mumonkan. Even if the blue ocean should turn into mountains, it will never be explained to you. Hongzhi again, just wash away the dust and dirt of subjective thoughts immediately. When the dust and dirt are washed away, your mind is open, shining brightly, without boundaries, without center or extremes. Completely whole, radiant with light, it shines through the universe, cutting through past, present, and future. So just this. this is inherent in you and does not come from outside. This is called the state of true reality. One who has experienced this can enter into all sorts of situations in response to all sorts of possibilities with subtle function that is marvelously effective and naturally uninhibited. So when we are unshackled from thoughts, unnecessary thoughts, that's when we function most effectively. We get a taste of this in Sesshin, especially late in Sesshin, where there's a flow that we can find. We just, without trying, it just, we find ourselves flowing, adapting to situations, to change, in a way that we're not used to doing outside Sesshin. It's because we don't have the encumbrances of thoughts. Here's saying something that I think most people hearing this will just know anyway. He says, ever since the time of the Buddha and the founders of Zen, there has never been any essential distinction between ordained and lay people, in the sense that everyone who has true personal experience of realization is said to have entered the school of the enlightened mind and penetrated the source. In Hongzhi's day, this might have been more of a radical statement. No distinction between ordained and lay people, because it was, the society was ordered more. The Dharma, the Buddhism was ordered more in terms of ordained as the elite and lay people as the rest. It's always a tricky balance to grant ordained people the respect that they have earned through their commitment to make this into a life work, a life calling, to respect them for that, but without overdoing that. The worldly life of people who have mastered Zen is buoyant and unbridled, like clouds making rain, like the moon in a stream, like an orchid in a remote spot, like spring in living beings. Their action is not self-conscious, yet their responses have order. This is what those who have mastered Zen do. I love all of these images, but this one is, I haven't seen anywhere else, like an orchid in a remote spot. When Zen practice is completely developed, there is no center, no extremes. There are no edges or corners. It is perfectly round and frictionless. He's pointing to a very exalted state, a very, very, very advanced state, completely developed. When practice is completely developed, who among us knows that? But we can imagine no center and no extremes, no edges or corners. Zen practice over time, it sort of sands down the sharp corners and the rough edges of our personalities. People who have been practicing for decades and you still see evidence of those sharp corners and rough edges, well, you can just be sure they would have been sharper and rougher before. And this, it is perfectly round and frictionless. I was just reading a book about the way that Buddhism changed in China. It changed China. Of course, Buddhism originated in India, this book said that one of the changes, one of the challenges of transplanting Buddhism from India to China was that the Chinese language is very much one of concrete images, whereas the Indian people of India are much more inclined toward abstractions and metaphysics and speculation. The Chinese are so down to earth in their concrete images, and so in rendering basic Indian Buddhist concepts into Chinese, they came up with concrete equivalents, or as they saw them, and so. Round, this is what he used the word round. Round is how they came up with perfection. In Indian Buddhism, the word was perfection, and they made it round. The Indian word for essence became I, E-Y-E. And the Indian word for true nature became original face. And from round comes the enso, this calligraphic circle, which arguably is as close as we can come in form to representing this formless true nature of ours. And so this is really the most important part of the raksu, is the circle, the ring. Reminds us that we are aspiring to live up to this round, perfect true nature of ours. Frictionless, no opposition. Or as we chant in Affirming Faith and Mind, not to. Here's another one. The time when you, quote, see the sun in daytime and see the moon at night, when you are not deceived, is the normal behavior of a Zen practitioner, naturally without edges or seams. If you want to attain this kind of normalcy, you have to put an end to the subtle pounding and weaving that goes on in your mind. The time when you see the sun in daytime and see the moon at night. It reminds me of Rinzai's response when he was asked what he realized, and he said that when hungry I eat, when tired I sleep. Or Dogen, his own version of that, when asked what he had realized, that my eyes are horizontal and my nose is vertical. Just that. Before awakening, we can imagine all kinds of exotic things about after enlightenment, exaggerated things. But really, it's awakening is just seeing things in a new way and yet plainly. And it is the great stage we have reached when we can become simply ordinary. Seeing things as they are, that's all. Not in a special way. Not through rainbows or other imaginary things, but just seeing things as they are, seeing people as they are. One more by Hongzhi. When you understand and arrive at the emptiness of all things, then you are independent of every state of mind and transcend every situation. Independent of every state of mind, detached from every state of mind. You see every state of mind as a state of mind, nothing more than a state of mind. This is a lot of what Sesshin work is about, is when we're a state of mind sweeps over us, something pleasant or unpleasant, is to see it as just a passing state. And that in that way we don't get caught in it. And you transcend every situation. The original light is everywhere. And you then adapt to the potential at hand. Everything you meet is the Dharma. While subtly aware of all circumstances, you are empty and have no subjective stance toward them. Empty, of course, always means free, open, unattached. Like the breeze in the pines, the moon in the water, there is a clear and light harmony. You have no coming and going mind, and you do not linger over appearances. Coming and going mind is a mind of restlessness, boredom, impatience. The essence, he says, is in being inwardly open and accommodating while outwardly responsive without unrest. Be like spring, causing the flowers to bloom, like a mirror reflecting images, and you will naturally emerge aloof of all tumult. He's throwing a lot of images at us, as did Dawei, and I think to inspire us to recognize what we can grow into through this practice, and to appreciate the quality of adapting, again, like clouds and water, reflecting the organic, natural unfolding of life through practice. One more here. This is by Zen Master Ying An. The mind of Zen practitioners is straight as a bowstring, like a long sword against the sky, cutting through confusion wherever they may be. Worldly wealth and status, nobility and extravagance, mundane desires, and all the ups and downs of life cannot affect them. Fame and profit, judgments of right and wrong, and all the possible states of being cannot trap them. This opening statement, the mind of Zen practitioners is straight as a bowstring. This inspired the name of our periodical, Zenbo. Another way to understand this is that the mind of the Zen adept is taut, ready like a drawn bow. It can only be ready like a drawn bow when it's free of thoughts. And then we're always poised to respond, not just in martial arts, but to respond to what is called for by people who are in need of help. This is the real inspiration of this. There's a pose of a Bodhisattva Guanyin, Kanon, called the posture of royal ease, where she or he is sitting with one knee up. I think we have this at the center. It's a very famous, magnificent painting. But that position, a posture of royal ease, is not just ease, but it's one in which the Bodhisattva is ready to spring forward to help. And then this listing of things that can upset our peace of mind in life, wealth and status, mundane desires, the ups and downs of life cannot affect them. There's a Zen saying, great winds are powerless to disturb the water of a deep well. In closing, just one more thing about the circle, which I forgot to read from. This is by Black Elk. You have noticed that everything an Indian does is a circle, And that is because the power of the world always works in circles and everything tries to be round. The sky is round, and I have heard that the earth is round like a ball, and so are all the stars. The wind in its greatest power whirls. Birds make their nests in circles, for theirs is the same religion as ours. The sun comes forth and goes down again in a circle. The moon does the same, and both are round. Even the seasons form a great circle in their changing and always come back to where they were. The life of a person is a circle from childhood to childhood, and so it is in everything where power moves. Time is up. We'll stop and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I vow to liberate endless blind matter. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind matter. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind matter. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain.